Welcome to the Smart Tech Check podcast, hosted by Mark Vina, your home for candid, insightful, and provocative conversations about the smart home, home automation, security, smartphones, PC and console gaming, and much more.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mark Vina, host of the Smart Tech Check podcast. Today is Friday, July 5th, 2024. It's my July 4th weekend holiday podcast. I'm joined today by Stuart Waupin, a frequent guest. In fact, he's a regular guest on my Smart Tech Check podcast. I've known Stuart for years. Unfortunately, maybe I should say unfortunately, Stuart. But no, it's not unfortunate. We're very, very, actually very good friends. We have a lot of mutual interests in the sports area because he's a big fan of baseball. We'll probably go into that for a couple of moments. But first, let me just check in with Stuart. How was your weekend? How was your holiday so far?
Slow. Nothing really exciting. I've become very jaded about the 4th of July. I've seen fireworks enough and the mob scenes. So we just stayed home and watched it on the TV.
Yeah. What I normally do, I'm a big fan of American history, despite the fact that my career has been in technology. I love watching the director's extended cut, not the original cut, but the director's extended cut of 1776, which is one
It was on TCM yesterday.
Yeah. Yep. And it's one of the few Broadway musicals that it's fairly accurate. I mean, there's some merging of characters, but
yes, they take some liberties.
It takes some liberties, but it was that won the best musical in 1969. You know, when you had, it was competing against shows like Hair, which you would think that might have, it's surprising that an Americana musical would win the Tony.
Well, it's very funny. The song, I can't remember the exact name of it, something about it's good to be a conservative or something like that.
Yeah, cool.
Apparently made Richard Nixon a big fan of the musical.
Yeah. Well, we got to talk about this for 1 minute. The cool thing about that, see, I love speaking to you about, because you're a movie buff as well, is that it was one of the few musicals where almost the entire original cast, there was a couple of actors from the original cast on Broadway they didn't use for the movie, but Jack Warner of Warner Brothers decided to, you know what, I'm not going to make the same mistake I made with My Fair Lady. He didn't cast Julie Andrews. For that, right? Audrey Hepburn. And by the way, the show itself is almost a duplication of the stage show. So they didn't take any liberties with the script.
They didn't open it up that much.
They added a couple of scenes for it, but there's a big number in there called Cool Considerament, where the conservatives, who are essentially...
Right, that's what I'm talking about.
Yes. Well, and it was in the film version, the version that I saw at 10 years old, when I was 10, when I saw it at Radio City Music Hall, because it played at Radio City Music Hall for, I think, 4 or 5 months when it premiered. It was one of the musical version was, I think, I think Hamilton has been done at the White House. It was done in the East Room at the White House while Nixon was president, and Nixon loved it, but he was not a big fan of the that number, Cool Considerate Men. So he called his buddy Jack Warner, said, "When you're making the film version, I would like you to delete that." And they did film the version.
Yes, they did.
But essentially, what happened was Jack Warner decided to delete it from all when it went into release. And they said, we burned the negatives and all that kind of stuff, but they kept it around, and it shows up in that extended cut. And I think I think it's a marvelous musical. And they did take a few liberties, but essentially it really represents what really happened. And I'm just a big fan of that number that Adam sees.
Lin-Manuel Miranda did cite it as a influence when he was doing Hamilton.
Right. Oh, absolutely. But that number he sings at the end, John Adams, when, the chips seem to be against them getting ratification. And remember, and that was all true, that they all agreed that every colony had to vote yay. That one colony that said, we're not going to vote for the Declaration of Independence.
New York.
Because they'd have to fight on the side of the British, and that would scuttle the whole deal. And that song that he sings at the end, Is Anybody There? Mm-hmm. Very interesting. That was culled from the letters that Adams, Franklin, and Jefferson, and Abigail Adams wrote together. And that one song lifts several passages from that letter he wrote.
I did not know that. That I didn't know.
No, it's fascinating. But we're not here to talk about...
No, American we're not.
That could be another podcast. So anyway, so let's talk about you. First of all, who you are. I know who you are. I've known you for years, but let's talk about a little bit your background.
Well, I've been writing about consumer electronics or consumer technology for 40 years. So I was at some of the very early press conferences where the compact disc was introduced. So I've been doing this a very long time. I've written the list of publications I've written for is rather lengthy over the period of time, both including consumer, niche magazines, hobbyists, and trade magazines. I've written for the Show Daily, the CES Show Daily, for almost its entire existence. The official Show Daily, I should say. So I also for CTA, the Consumer Technology Association, the folks who put on CES, since 2000, I've been writing the bios for the Consumer Technology Association Hall of Fame, and I've also written for them what is now around a 50,000-word history of the industry that they had been publishing up until about 2019. Mm-hmm. So I've been the tech historian for almost a quarter century.
Well, and we're going to get into that in about a moment. But the other thing, and the reason why I have that Mets logo up there is no surprise to people who would obviously be baseball fans. Stuart is a hardcore Mets fan. I love talking to him about baseball because, again, you approach things in a very historical context type of way. I mean, we talk about 1776 and all the drama that was behind the musical itself and behind the writing of the show. But it's fascinating talking to you, Stuart, and I mean that very genuinely because, you know, you do have a historical perspective on things. And I'm going to date myself while, you talk about people and, oh, well, we don't really care about history. We only care about where we are right now. History is all we got. I don't care whether it's sports, whether it's movies, whether it's theater, but especially whether it's politics. It's all about history. And if you all of a sudden erase parts of history or you ignore parts of history, the axiom is true. People who, you know, forget about history are doomed to repeat the mistakes.
It goes a little beyond that, which is the purpose of this whole podcast, as well as the reason behind it, which is a series of histories I'm writing for Twice Magazine, which is the largest trade publication in the industry, on the commemoration of CTA's 100th anniversary. It was founded in April 1924. So I've been writing this series of histories dating back to the 20s, hopefully getting up to the modern time. I'm up until the late 20th century at this point. But it goes beyond not repeating history. Because in our industry, and I'm sure in a lot of industries, but I'm talking about merely our industry, is that there is very little that's new outside of the actual devices. And what I have found in my study of tech history is that if you even go back to the 20s, the way that technology comes out of development labs or R&D labs or entrepreneurs or whatever and makes it to the mainstream has not changed at all in more than a century. So it's not about not forgetting history. It's about going back and learning why things succeeded and why things failed. Right. And you can apply the same things that happened a century ago to new products being introduced today. And so it's not a matter about forgetting history, but going back before you even introduce something, understand why things succeed and why things failed. And it's all laid out in the history of our industry because so little has actually changed behind the technologies.
Well, the only caveat that I would say about that, and I agree with all that, is that especially technology, but it's true of other industries as well. You know, it's a fascinating industry because it's a category made of people, personalities, many often larger than life personalities, both the good and bad with that. We see that today. And what's really fascinating is that, and I've said this before to people, is that, you know, you flash back 30 years, you didn't have CNBC, you didn't have Fox News Business, which, you know, there's been this kind of growth in that business people become media stars, you know, and you really didn't have that 30 or 40 years. Yeah, you may have had a Lee Iacocca that would do TV commercials, but they were not the stars themselves. It was their companies. And that has changed over the last, I think, 20 years with the advent of the internet and event that, you know, you could do podcasts and things like that, where everybody becomes a media star. And as you know, Stuart, I'm sure you could talk about this quite a bit. These personalities, some are well known, some of them are unknown. The unknown personalities are really the fun ones, where, you know, wow, I didn't realize they were part of this. You don't sometimes realize that they will counsel more senior people, you know, especially more junior people. You know, you've got a technology leader who is kind of the face of the company, and they may be getting counsel. Hey, you know, we better do this. We can't, you know, maybe we're in a position of success and we do not want to change gears. I mean, look what happened with Netflix and Blockbusters. Hey, folks, this is Mark Vina, CEO of Smart Tech Research. Smart Tech Research is proud to have Aura sponsoring my Smart Tech Check podcast. Aura Security Software is the all-in-one digital safety net for the whole family. It's literally like having a personal cyber guardian that protects all of the devices in your home on a 24/7 basis. What's more, its AI functionality stands out as it constantly learns and adapts to threats, keeping your family and you safe around the clock. It's a must-have solution for anyone serious about online security. Stay tuned for a special no-obligation promo offer for Aura that will give you cybersecurity peace of mind.
Hi, I'm Anna with Smart Tech Research. Whether you're browsing the web, checking emails, monitoring your children's online behavior, spam calls and identity protection, and conducting online transactions, Aura has your back, ensuring a secure and seamless experience every time. Aura's comprehensive security solutions are compatible with Microsoft Windows, Apple Mac OS, Android, iOS, and iPad OS devices. For an exclusive 14-day no-obligation trial version of Aura, use the on-screen QR code or visit the website shown here. Aura is the smart, simple way to stay safe online.
Fascinating deep dive on the History Channel the other day, and that, you know, Blockbuster was, and you might even bring this up during the podcast, Blockbuster was almost an impregnable brand in the late 90s, and they just couldn't see streaming coming. You know?
Well, the lesson behind that, and again, it goes back to before that, you can go back to Kodak. Kodak invented the digital camera. And like Blockbuster didn't think that streaming was going to be anything, Kodak was afraid that if they went forward and developed the digital camera, that it would cannibalize their film business, which they were the 900-pound gorilla on. Sure. So they ignored it. And look what happened to Kodak.
Well, and Kodak isn't
even the first example. It's just merely the most familiar example.
But the lesson there is, and it's true of Blockbuster, it's true of the Blockbuster and the current environment, that the situation when the company is sitting on a cash cow, where you're highly profitable, your revenue is growing, there's always a huge reluctance not to change horses.
That's correct.
Not to change gears.
That has happened multiple times throughout our history. And one only has to go back and see and derive the lessons that have been there are multiple examples of this, and yet people keep falling into the trap because they don't recognize that their situation is not new or unique.
Right. I mean, you know what? It's an interesting story, and I don't know whether you cover this in your series, but to me was the announcement of the IBM PC in 1981, and I mean, the lots and lots of stories, you know, about how IBM got into that business. That could be a podcast by itself. But there was a fascinating story that when IBM needed to find an operating system for their original PC. They knew if they were going to get this project, and I think they had about a year to get this project out the door. That was the marching order.
Hey,
you know, you got to do it in 6 months or left. There was a guy named Philip Estridge who died in a plane crash in the mid 80s while he was he wasn't a vice president. I think he was a director of marketing. He was given a small team. He had to do off the shelf parts. There's a long, long story. But when they had to find an operating system, they knew they were going to have to use some type of third party non-IBM OS. Non-developed IBM OS because I didn't have the expertise to do that. And the fascinating story is that whole CPM story where they went to Was it Gary Kildall, if I'm not mistaken? Yeah,
and it was not IBM that did that. It was and it wasn't. It's a bit of a convoluted story, but what ended up happening was that Bill Gates essentially bought CPM,
yes,
and from the Seattle company, and basically rewrote it to create MS-DOS. But when he bought it, he didn't tell the guys that he bought it from, Kilduff and those guys, he didn't tell them the deal that he had already made with IBM. He took on the IBM deal without having an OS.
Yes. Well, that's the funny thing about that story.
Very, very ballsy move on Gates' part.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's a story, you know, when you worked for IBM, it's still true that IBM, when they would want to partner with you, they would show up to 45 lawyers, you know, 10 marketing people. At the time, I think Kildall he wasn't a big fan of IBM, at least because they were kind of a monolithic type of company that had that kind of reputation. And I think the story was, you know, correct me, Gary, Stuart. Gary Kildall was flying. He went to the house. He didn't want to sign the NDA. IBM had this massive NDA, you know, that you had to sign. IBM, you know, door number two, they go to see Gates. And they fly out to Seattle. I think I forget what part of Seattle they were in, but they apparently went up there. They had a small strip office in a strip park. Essentially what they did, you know, Gates walks out. I think the guy who was with leading the IBM team thought he was the office boy because he looked like he was about 14 years old. And like you suggested, he just signed the NDA. Hey, what do I got to lose? You know? And that of course, that led to the fact that we're going to go out and buy with, essentially buy CPM and do a makeover of it. And of course, the great deal was that they didn't take up a upfront fee. I mean, I think IBM thought they were going to sell maybe over the life of the cycle of the IBM PC, maybe 50,000 PCs. And rather than accept a big, heavy development fee, a one-time fee, they negotiated a per device agreement with IBM. So every time IBM sold a PC, they got 35.
The important part of that story is not necessarily the where and who, where they went. Two things. One is that IBM, like we were just talking about Kodak and Blockbuster, IBM was ignoring what was happening in the personal computer space because they were so big and had such a lock on the corporate business. They thought that that what was happening in the personal or home computer business were gnats flying around their face until guys like DEC and HP and some of their other corporate competitors began to get into the space, and then they started to panic. And that's why they had to go to Gates. It wasn't like they couldn't do an operating system. They realized that within the IBM hierarchy, it was going to be difficult to do it.
And the mistake
that IBM made was not necessarily finding a third party to do it, but granting the third party non-exclusivity.
Yes.
In other words, Bill Gates was free to peddle that operating system
anywhere they wanted to
outside of IBM. And the fact that IBM put together the IBM PC not as a proprietary machine, but using off-the-shelf parts and software, meaning that almost anybody could reverse engineer it without incurring any kind of IP issues.
Right.
And the fact that the operating system was non-exclusive is the story behind all of that. The fact that IBM ignored it too long and then suddenly panicked and realized they had to get something out there. And what a lot of people don't remember is, we remember the outcome that IBM has now gotten out of the hardware business because they essentially got their lunch eaten by people like Apple and Compaq and people of that nature. But IBM was fairly dominant. In fact, they were entirely dominant in the corporate space with the IBM PC for years. What really doomed that whole effort was not the IBM PC, not the Microsoft deal, but the IBM PC Junior. They were trying to get out of the office, which is where they were still dominant with the IBM PC, and tried to make a home computer to battle Apple and to battle Compaq and those guys. And that's where they fell down on their faces when they tried to get out of the office.
I was working at IBM at that time. IBM was my first job. I was there. I was actually there as an intern when they announced the IBM PC. They struggled. This is going to sound weird. they struggled with the success of the IBM PC because if you look at their business back then, it was largely a leasing model. They used to sell big gear. Mm-hmm. They were even frustrated when they came out with systems like the System 23 and which we call the data center. Systems that were they weren't personal computers, but they were scaled down, big iron hardware. But their big deal was, hey, Mr. Corporation, we're going to sell you a $2 million system with terminals that didn't have intelligence. And every time we upgrade those, we're going to increase the leasing price X number of dollars. They want to lock you into a lease for life. The whole idea of PCs were completely antagonistic to that. And they struggled with that. And mm-hmm. frankly, it's really weird because I agree with you. The PC Junior, which was the code name was the Peanut, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
That was kind of a dumbed down IBM PC.
Extraordinarily dumbed down.
Yeah, yeah, and it had the famous
Chiclet keyboard.
Oh my God, we're now dating ourselves. But you know, we can talk about that forever. But let me ask you a question before we go to the next one. If there were, in terms of egregiousness, is there an example that we haven't talked about where a company should have eaten its lunch? So to sometimes you have to catabolize yourself to stay in business. And we were talking about examples of companies that chose not to do that. I mean, Kodak could have easily done that. They had a high profit business model with developing film. They would sell film. They would develop film and sell chemicals to different local retailers that do that. Is there any other egregious example in your history book that says, you know what, if this company had decided to cannibalize itself, they might still be around?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I'm going to go in the other direction.
Okay.
And a lot of what ended up happening, remember that for about the first 50 years of our industry, from the mid-1920s up until the mid-1970s, there was only one company that meant anything in our industry, and that was RCA. And mm-hmm. RCA meant everything, primarily because David Sarnoff was in charge of it. You were talking about that there weren't media stars. David Sarnoff was a huge media star because not only did he own by far the largest consumer technology company in the world, other than IBM, which is much more corporate, so consumer technology company, but he also ran NBC. He ran RKO movie studios. The guy was a mogul, much more of a mogul than any of the guys, the media stars that followed him, including Elon Musk. Okay, so what ends up happening is what happens with big companies, and a lot of other companies have gone through this, Sony being the most prominent example, is that they get big enough that they think that they're the only one, that they can set the marketplace. And when David Sarnoff was in charge, they pretty much could. And then comes the post-VCR period when everybody is trying to do optical discs. Video on disc, digital on disc. This is after the CD. So we're getting into the mid-80s. David Sarnoff has been dead for 15 years. RCA is being run by other people now. And RCA decides that even though Laserdisc already exists, that they decide because they're RCA, they can come up with a better idea that they can dominate the market with. And they come up with something called CED. And I'll apologize. I can't remember what CED stands for, but it's Capacitance something something disc. The problem was it was not an optical disc. The RCA engineers came up with something that was essentially a record-playing video disc. It played with an actual physical stylus. And you put the thing in the machine and a stylus would move along a groove just like a record, which means every time you played the disc, a little bit of the disc would degrade just like a record does. And they introduced this with a huge amount of publicity. They hired Gene Kelly to be the spokesperson for it. And I got to meet Gene Kelly, which is a whole nother story. But the thing failed miserably because it was such a stupid idea. Everybody is playing with lasers and RCA is playing with a phonograph needle to play a video disc. And that device and RCA's arrogance thinking that they could just step in and come out with their own device, their own video disc device to dominate the market, destroyed RCA. Right. They end up getting sold to GE, which had originally founded them to begin with in 1919. And then they get sold to Thompson, the French company Thompson. And then it was finally just splintered apart and the brand name licensed to anybody who wanted to use it. Remember, the first TCL TVs that were sold in the U.S. were sold under the RCA brand.
Right.
That's now, what happened. And that's all a result of CED and RCA's belief that they were still dominant enough in the industry that they could just force their device will on the industry.
Yeah. So I want to spend the next 5 or 6 minutes of the podcast on these two themes that we chatted about before we started the podcast thing. This is notion of, you know, when you work in this industry, and you and I have chatted about this before, every time you meet with a company, we get, you know, 20 pitches a day. And, you know, and many of these companies are started by engineers, and they think that whatever their solution is, they think it's going to change the world. And which is great to see that from an excitement standpoint, but you know deep in your heart, it might have a value proposition, but it's not totally disruptive. It might be disruptive in a certain narrow space, but in terms of how it applies to the rest of the market. And you've made the point, which I think is an accurate one, that disruptive is a very, very high bar, especially if it's genuine. Meaning that, and when you look at the whole landscape of disruptive technologies, the list is really not that long. Nope. You know, I mean, it's actually relatively narrow. What I mean by that, and I'm sure what you mean by that, is that does it change your lifestyle in a multi-year extended basis? You know, and there are still technologies with us that were around 80 years ago that are still with us today. They may have morphed into other things 100 years ago. So I want to, you know, pin your brain about that because let's talk about that whole idea of, you know, that high bar of technology that really has to change the game to be labeled disruptive.
Well, most formats, whether it's whether it's a record player, you know, like a vinyl record or CD or audio or videotape, physical hardware devices usually have a lifespan of about 20 or 30 years. And things that we think in terms of their being at the peak of their popularity and really meaning something. Whereas opposed to truly disruptive technologies are almost permanent. And the funniest thing that I have discovered about our industry is that our industry was essentially established by one person. It's very funny that you go back and our industry was established by GE chairman Owen Young back in 1919. And it's a long story, which I explore in a series before the current one, where he invents RCA as a way of creating an American radio industry. But when CTA was formed, CTA was formed as the Radio Manufacturers Association. Because for the first 20, 25 years, again, radio being a device, it was almost the only device for a very long period of time. But what I've discovered is that radio, we continue to be the radio industry because almost every single disruptive technology that has emerged since the founding of CTA in 1924 is based on radio. Yes. Television is video over radio.
Right.
Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, cellular, this is all radio. These are still stuff. Heinrich Hertz discovering radio waves in the late 1880s and Nikola Tesla discovering radio control of things. Almost all of our disruptive devices, what we're doing now, anything that's done in the air without wires is radio. We are still the radio industry, despite satellites sending TV signals and radio signals and GPS, radio. Almost our entire industry is exactly the way we started.
Yes.
Radio. And it's radio is more than a century old as a technology. And what started our entire industry was radio. And that's what we're still dealing with today, and we will still be dealing with for a very long period of time.
Now, as we kind of wrap this up in the couple of minutes we have left, is there any interesting things in your research and these stories they're factual articles that you've written? Anything that would kind of blow you away, that would blow the average person away? Do you have a short story that, hey, by the way, this may not be, you know, completely visible to many people, and then I might surprise them?
The thing that I'm largely focused on is the people. Everybody writes about the technology, and what we've been talking about is the technology. What I'm trying to insert, all product, devices, technologies, they all came from somebody's head. And the issue that I'm dealing with, or what I'm trying to focus on in this series, is who these people are, so we understand that there are actual human beings. For instance, there's a guy who invented the digital camera. Not many people know that. There's a guy who led the team to develop the cellular phone. There's a guy, Don Linder. I have spoken to him. He led a team of about a dozen and a half engineers and invented the cell phone. There's a guy, you know, the microprocessor from Intel, or it's Intel invented the microprocessor. There's a guy who led that development effort, Ted Hoff. So our history is filled with all of these very unknown engineers who are at GPS. And was invented by an Air Force colonel named Brad Parkinson, who saw the project through to its inauguration. So there are these individual peoples who most people don't know. But the thing that surprised me was the role of lawyers that has played throughout our history. And you laugh, but Judge Harold Green, and a lot of this in January of 1984, which I found interesting. On January 1st, 1984, Judge Harold Green officially broke up AT&T, which made our entire home phone business possible.
Baby bells.
Baby bells is exactly right. So our entire telecommunication system was inalterably changed by an antitrust suit brought by DOJ, decided by Judge Harold Green. Yes. Then you have the Sony decision, which came up less than 3 weeks after Harold Green broke up AT&T. The Sony suit was, remember, the VCR came out in 1975, the Sony Betamax, and immediately Hollywood sued.
Fair use.
Because they said anybody at home who's recording one of our television shows
is violating our copyrights.
And this went all the way to the Supreme Court. And Judge John Paul Stevens believed in Sony's argument, which was presented by Sony's lawyer by the name of Dean Dunlavey, D-E-A-N-L-A-V-E-Y. Who carried the case through for Sony. And Justice Stevens, at the time that it was going after oral arguments, it was going to be 6-3 against Sony. And John Paul Stevens believed in Sony's argument and managed to convince William Brenner and Sandra Day O'Connor to switch their votes. And so on, I think, January 17th, 1984, by a 5-4 margin, the Supreme Court ruled for Sony. Now, why is that important? When you go on your cable box today or your satellite guide and you want to record a show and you just push a button to record that show, that doesn't happen without that 5-4 decision and Judge Stevens convincing two of his justices to change their votes.
Well, it might have still happened, but it would have resulted in higher fees because they would have said
it might not. You have to remember that at the time, VCR makers had already made recording shows off the air almost impossible. They did nothing to fix the fact that you couldn't set the damn clock on the VCR. There's actually a Wikipedia entry on the flashing 12 syndrome of the VCR of the late 70s and early 80s, because the VCR companies all believed they were going to lose that case. And so they were making recording as difficult as possible. There was also a movement talking about it being more expensive, that there was going to be a federal tax placed on all blank video cassettes. So every kind of recording, it wasn't just TV recording, it was also the whole mixtape effort. And that, of course, leads to the MP3 player, a judge deciding that the Diamond Rio in 1998 was a legal device, which leads this device right before the iPod from Apple. And she decided, based on the Sony, using the Sony decision as sort of a precedent, that home recording rights for audio were almost the same thing. So that Sony decision was a pebble in a pond with huge ripples. And we can argue whether or not we would have gotten to where we are now if the court had ruled against it or not. But the fact is, we didn't have to worry about that. We didn't have to worry about anything about home recording of audio, video, of making mixtapes, of having the DVR with TiVo or replay or any of these technologies that we now take for granted, all because John Paul Stevens managed to convince two Supreme Court justices and allow us to record Kojak while we were watching Columbo.
Well, Stu, we're going to have to end it here. I mean, I could talk about this forever. After I post this, I'm sure you're going to send out the links to my reply to my original post with the stories, because it's really interesting stuff, and I really encourage people to read it. But again,
it's on twice.com.
Great, great. Well, Stuart, thanks for taking the time and joining me for today's podcast. For our viewing and listening audience, thanks for making the Smart Tech Check podcast part of your day or commute. Please make sure that you hit the like and subscribe buttons at the end of today's podcast, or use these on-screen QR codes to connect with me. You can also follow me on X at Mark Vina Tech Guy. Thanks again, Stuart, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Mark.